Welcome to the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church. We hope our broadcast will bless you.
This time, I'd invite those that are able to kneel as we seek the Lord in prayer. It's our custom in Midland to invite those that wish to come forward and join us here. Father, we thank you for the chance to come before you this morning. We thank you for the beautiful weather you've given us, and for this house of worship, and the fact that we're all safe and together here today. We know that there have been disasters and tornadoes and other events throughout the past week, and we ask especially that you be close to those that have been affected by these events. We know that there are some that are not with us today because of illness or other difficulties, and we also ask that you be especially with them. There are meetings also in Midland, and we ask that you bring a special blessing to those that are meeting there this morning. We ask that you open our hearts this morning and help us to prepare ourselves to hear your word and make us receptive to what you have to say for us today. Thank you again for everything that you've done for us. In your name, amen.
Time for the children's story.
You know what day tomorrow is? It's Mother's Day, that's right. Does anybody here not have a mother? You have a mother? I think everybody here has a mother. There are different types of mothers. When we lived before we came here, our neighbors had a house, and in front of that was a great big tree. And on top of the tree was a great big nest, and there were some eagles that lived in there. And so the mother eagle would come and go out over the lake and catch fish and bring them to their little baby eagles, and then all summer we could watch them get bigger and learn to fly, and that was a lot of fun. Do you have something to say? Did you see a baby chicken in the nest?
There was a nest.
Those are fun to look in, aren't they? Any of you ever seen a robin's nest? Do you ever see the mother robin feed worms and things to the babies? You did? I bet your mother wasn't real happy about that, was she? Well, God made all different types of mothers, and I was very lucky. I had a wonderful mother that took care of me, and I can tell by how well kept all you kids are and how your clothes are neat that your mothers are taking good care of you. Has anyone ever heard of a cowbird? Well, a cowbird is a bird that usually lives on the prairies or in open spaces. And a lot of people think the cowbird's not a very nice bird and not a very good mother. Does anybody know why? Why?
Just mean to people?
Well, a cowbird isn't too mean to people. But the cowbird does something very interesting. When the cowbird gets ready to have a baby and to lay its eggs, the cowbird doesn't build a nest. The cowbird looks around and finds another bird that's building a nest. And when the mother cowbird looks and says, well, I think this would be a good nest for me to use, and she goes and lays an egg there. And then she goes away. And let's say the other bird was a red-winged blackbird. And then when the mother blackbird comes, she doesn't realize that that wasn't her egg there. And so she has her own eggs, and she has the egg of the cowbird. And when the cowbird hatches, she thinks that belongs to her. And so the blackbird will raise the cowbird. And sometimes the cowbirds actually crowd the other birds out of the nest. And so a lot of people say, well, the cowbirds aren't very nice and the mothers aren't very good. But does anybody know why they did this? Why do you think? Well, I don't know if this is the real reason or not, but what some biologists say is that cowbirds used to follow the buffalo. And out on the plains, the buffalo would go through the prairie and it would kick up a lot of dirt and seeds and insects, and so the cowbirds would follow them and would get their meals that way. But the buffalo didn't stay in one place for a long time. And so if the cowbird stayed in one place and sat on the nest for a long time, then the buffalo would be gone and they wouldn't be able to get their meals and stuff as well. So the cowbirds decided to have foster parents raise their kids. Now, I don't know if that's really true or not, but it's kind of an interesting thing. And it's really interesting how God made different animals and different mothers to raise their kids in different ways. Okay, you can go back to your seats now. Our scripture this morning comes from Mark chapter 5, verse 19. Howbeit, Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, Go home to thy friends, and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. Our sermon this morning is being brought to us by Mick Thurber. It's a previously recorded sermon that was given at the Loma Linda University Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Good evening. How are God's people tonight? It's so great to be here. Our family has found a wonderful home in Texas, and we love our folks there, love our church, love our campus. But I spent 18 years of my life in Southern California. Randy, it almost feels like I have home field advantage here tonight. So good to be here with so many that I know and love. Although, you know, when you're away from California, even for a little while and come back, you're always surprised at what you find. I was in Vaughn's this week just to pick up a few things from my motel room, and as I was walking in, I noticed a vending machine on the left. I didn't pay much attention to it, but you know the kind. Drop in a couple of quarters and hit like C8, a little bag of Doritos pops out, or a Snickers or something like that. Well, on my way out, I had to notice it because the exit path took me right toward it. Didn't take quarters in this vending machine. It would require your debit card or your credit card. You hit C8 after your credit card goes in, an iPod Nano would drop down. Where else but in California is there an iPod dispenser in a supermarket? It's quite a place, California. It's good to be here. There's a relatively new word in my own personal lexicon. It's called backstory. Easy to define. Backstory means kind of the story behind the story. The concept's been around a lot longer than the word has. In fact, there's an ancient Hindu epic that was written, Mahabharata, that's got 24,000 verses in the actual story. But the author wrote another 56,000 verses to explain the background for the regular story. Proof of our own fascination about the backstory is the 1 billion with a B, 1,122,100,000 that people in the United States alone spent just to have George Lucas tell us how and why Anakin Skywalker became Darth Vader. But with a few words from Mark chapter 5, we sort of break in on a couple of stories already in progress. And in both cases, the backstories are not just interesting, they're important. And both stories place the matchless charms of Christ on full display in all their glory. Here are the words that we break in on. The woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. The second one, just a few words later, your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? Let's go to chapter 5 of the book of Mark, and let's read a little more of the backstory and get into the full story. Mark chapter 5. We'll begin with verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over the boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came when he saw Jesus, and he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. So Jesus went with him. You'd have to understand the progression of this story. Just a bouncing 12-year-old girl. I've got a 13-year-old daughter at home, so I know exactly how Jairus must have felt. Everything was going along fine, but she came home with a headache one day, and that headache grew worse, and pretty soon she had to be in bed, and then she was more and more sick, and you know, it was just too far to take her over to Loma Linda Children's Hospital. So I just did the best they could and tried to revive her, but instead of getting better, she just kept getting worse. Soon became obvious that if something didn't happen, they were going to lose their little girl. Oh, this struck the heart of that father so deeply. He thought, she's so young. She hasn't even started to live yet. There's only a few words that have been written in the pages of her young life. So against his better judgment, but now desperate, he began to wonder if maybe the words, the rumors that he'd been hearing about this Jesus might be true after all. Because if he is the Messiah, he could help. And so he went and found Jesus. He happened to be close by. He begged Jesus to come home with him. So he allowed himself to feel just a little hope when Jesus agreed to come home with him. But just as he thought he had Jesus' attention, the strangest thing happened. He started to move kind of in slow motion. Not only was Jesus sort of taking his own time, this Jesus was easily distracted. Let's keep reading. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she just grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? I can just imagine this man's internal conversation. Oh no! Just when I thought I had Jesus' attention focused on my needs, somebody else grabs his attention. Now, I know this woman's sick. I've been the one that's kept her out of the synagogue for the last 12 years. But for goodness sake, what difference would another day or two make to her? I need Jesus now. And of course, the guilt probably came as he witnessed Jesus' tender compassion with this woman. Verse 31, you see the people crowding against you, his disciples asked, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. He didn't get a long time to wallow in his guilt because, you see, even guilt can be trumped. And a broken heart is enough to do it. Because while Jesus is busy being nice to somebody else, there's news from home, but it's not good news. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus. Your daughter is dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? So now, think of his struggle. He's got to try to understand why a God who seems so close didn't take care of his need. When you start thinking about that, other questions will pop up. Did he not hear me? Did he not understand how serious my need was? Why couldn't he get around to helping me? Why do I always feel like I'm on the other side of somebody else's miracle? She got healed? Anybody here have a life story that maybe evoked such questions? I mean, here we are, you know, doing the best we can. We're like Paul, fighting the good fight, trying to be faithful because we want God to know that we believe in him. But then something happens in our lives and we wonder if he believes in us. And we know that we're told that each of our lives is a part of this grand story, and God is the great author writing this magnificent epic that encompasses the entire universe. Is that any comfort? You know how small that makes you feel? Does my little story matter in this grand scheme? If God's the author and I'm just playing a part that he's writing, where does that leave me? Is my well-being even a consideration in the story that he writes? And if we're all just characters in God's grand story, is all we're left with just to play the parts and roles that we're prescribed? And some of us look at our stories and we just see them spiraling down. And we wonder, do our stories really matter? It's almost enough to make you give up. Were it not a jolt from Jesus to get us out of our stinking thinking, we might just give up. For against all logic, against every reality we know, and counter to the direction our storylines have taken, Jesus asks something of us. Back to the word, verse 36. Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." Does that sound a little bit like, "Don't worry, be happy"? Believe? Believe what? Jesus, what about my daughter is dead? Don't you understand? Jesus, do you not know what the word cancer means? When you saw me get that pink slip at work, Lord, do you not know what the words laid off means? Jesus, I haven't had a peaceful conversation with my spouse in 15 years. What about my storyline? Don't you understand, Jesus? But then with what I am sure was a twinkle in his eye, Jesus set about doing something that strikes me as a perfect picture of all he intends for everyone in his grand story. Because he takes a few hand-picked disciples and they burst into the room with mom and dad where this little girl lies dead. Verse 41, he takes her by the hand and says, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. Like I said, I understand how he must have felt, because I have a 13-year-old right now. You know, I like to view these two stories together because when they're placed together, they make such encouraging statements to me. Because I have a life story just like you. And I have questions about it just as you must. When I see these two stories together, I'm so encouraged because the first thing I see is that every story is important to Jesus. Every story counts. You got Jairus on the one hand. He's probably a rich guy. He's got prestige. He's well known and well liked in the community. And you got this nameless woman on this side. She's almost a nobody. You got the important and the insignificant. And yet, isn't it amazing how great need is a great equalizer? Because they both desperately needed Jesus. As it turns out, they both needed a resurrection of sorts. Seeing the resurrection that Jairus and his family needed, that one's an easy one. But don't overlook the resurrection this woman received. You see, she was afflicted with, for lack of a better term, and I'm sorry if this makes you uncomfortable, a chronic menstrual disorder. And the fact that she was innocent in the face of this disease did nothing to lessen the obligations it meant for her. Look it up in Leviticus sometime and you'll see how stringent the rules were. She was depleted in almost every way you can imagine. First of all, there's the physical depletion. I used to have a friend whose cycle was kind of stuck so that about every 2 weeks it started instead of every four. After about 3 months of this, those of us that were good friends with this person could tell in her person how tired she began to look, how drained she began to look. There was probably a little anemia involved. And that's not even to mention the other symptoms that would go along with it. It took a while for them to get her regulated. But they could, because we've got medicines today that can help do that. This lady had none of those advantages for 12 years. Half of us here can't even understand what that's like. The other half don't even want to try to understand what that's like. But it was brutal. Physically, she was a waste. She was broke because she spent all our money with a doctor, so she probably dressed crummy. She didn't have the latest haircut. She didn't have any good makeup. But mostly, it was the isolation that was the problem for her, because, you see, she couldn't be in polite company. Because she was always unclean. She had to always be on the edge. She had to be away from everybody. She had no right to be in the synagogue, so she had no spiritual life. She could have no social life, because the minute she'd go around a group of people, she'd make them unclean. I don't know if she was married or not, but I don't know how she could have stayed married to be intimately unavailable for 12 years. Would be a very difficult thing for any marriage to survive. She was used to seeing more people from the back who were turning around and running away from her than looking people in the eye, which is maybe why she felt like she couldn't look Jesus in the eye and ask for healing. She'd have to be content to reach down and touch his garment. You know, I read those words that she came and trembled after the healing. That just breaks my heart. Because there are some of us that feel guilty when we get healing and wholeness. She was of that kind because of all the isolation that she'd experienced for all of those years. But look how Jesus resurrected her. Verse 34, he said, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." You know what? I don't think she heard but one word that Jesus said. The first word. Daughter. The rest of it didn't matter. Because for the first time in 12 years, somebody said something to her that made her feel like she belonged. Daughter is a word of belonging, family. It says you're important. You're a part of me. Oh, that was a glorious resurrection for her. She came and got the healing that she wanted. But Jesus gave her the healing she needed. And in the end, they were both equal, weren't they? I don't know where you are in the gamut between the important and the insignificant, but it doesn't matter. Because our need makes us the same. So no matter where you are, it's not just that even your story matters to Jesus, it is that especially your story matters to Jesus. The second thing that I love about this story that helps me, I'm going to introduce by another story, Sussi's story. This is a true story. It comes out of Hitler's Germany, Munich, on a snowy day. Sussi, a middle-aged Jewish woman, boards the bus. She tries to keep a low profile, as they all did during those years. The bus had only gone a little ways, and some SS stormtroopers pulled the bus over, jumped on board, and started demanding to look at everybody's papers, and they worked their way methodically down the aisle. As soon as she realized what was happening, she began to cry and whimper, and then she began to shake a little bit. And the closer they got, the more she began to cry, and the more she began to shake. The gentleman next to her says, "What's wrong?" She says, "You have papers that I don't have. When they get back to me, they're going to take me off this bus, and they're going to put me on that bus that they pulled up behind us, and I'm going to be taken away, and I'm never going to see my family again." And when the man heard that, he just blew up at her, started yelling at her, "You blankety blank, you're embarrassing. I hate to even be seen with you. I hate to even be sitting beside you." Of course, that got the attention of the troopers. They dropped what they were doing and immediately made their way to the back of the bus to see what all the ruckus was about. You know, the thing that I like this story of these two people in Mark 5 is it tells me that there's a surprise ending in store for every believer. And some of us need a surprise ending. Sussi sure did. When the troopers got back, they looked at the man and said, "What's the problem here?" He said, "Oh, my stupid wife, I keep telling her every time we get ready to go out the door, don't forget your papers, but she forgot them again. She is so embarrassing, just makes me so mad. I don't know how we get along with our women." The trooper just rolled his eyes and said, "Yeah, I know what you mean." And he went right on by and got off the bus. Sussi never knew his name. Never even saw him again, but what a surprise ending. You know, chances are pretty good if you've lived any time at all on this earth, you've had some storylines that ended in some ways that you could have never guessed. And a lot of them are probably very, very tragic, very painful. Things have happened that you could have never predicted would happen. And you've had enough surprises already that you're not even sure you want any more, even if they're from God. But then Jesus goes to work and things happen. Things that we don't think could ever happen. Let's go back to verse 42 again. This is where he healed her. Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. There's a couple of words I didn't read the first time. At this, they were completely astonished. Now, I don't know the difference really between astonished and completely astonished, but I'm going to give it a shot here. 2 weeks ago, the inevitable candidate, Hillary Clinton, was astonished that she didn't win Iowa. And then 5 days later with Barack Obama, 12 points up. I think he was completely astonished he didn't win New Hampshire. I don't know why they use that extra word there, but completely astonished. In other words, when Jesus goes to work in your life, it's going to blow you away. Neither Jairus nor the woman who was healed could possibly have guessed this is how their stories were going to end that day. The two resurrections and their stories could only happen for one reason. That's because Jesus himself entered their stories. The deal is that sometimes we just forget how deeply Jesus steps in to our lives. You see, when Jesus comes into our lives, he doesn't have the intention to just sort of fiddle around the edges. See, there's a scripture I want to point you to. It's one of the crown jewels of the New Testament. One of my favorite verses. I try to use it every chance I get, every excuse I can. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. Just read you this one verse. There's a whole beautiful context to it. We'll just read the one verse. Paul reminds us that God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. See, Jesus looked at our sorry storylines and he said, "You folks are a mess. I can't fix you up just by tweaking a few lines in your story. It's too far gone. I can't just tweak. It won't do it. Besides that, there's a writer's strike going on." I probably shouldn't have said that. I don't know. Jesus said, "How about I just swap stories with you? Straight up. My righteousness for your sin. Do we have a deal?" Wow. But then some of you might say, "Yeah, but I've seen people who've made that swap, and you know what? They still have problems in their lives." Well, yeah. It's because another author has been given permission for a little while yet to write some storylines in our lives. We know him to be an enemy because every line he writes ends up in pain and destruction. Jesus just wants you to remember, though, that regardless of whatever lines the enemy tries to write for your life, he isn't allowed to write the ending. When you swap your story with Jesus, the ending is already written. That's why he has the audacity to say, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." Now, you know, there's a bonus here. This is so cool. When you make this swap, this is what happens. You don't have to wait till the end of your life to experience the end of your story. You see, once you make that swap, eternity starts for you that moment. I know there's some resistance to that because some people say, "Yeah, but I buy into that. There's some stuff I can't do." Well, yeah. So, there's a whole lot more you will be able to do. Trust me. Just try it. But a lot of us think, I'm not sure I can feel safe about that swap, Mick. See, I've got serious concerns about my trade-in value. My story's a mess right now, but you don't even know my backstory. I don't have any trade-in value. When our family lived in Carolina, we were teaching at Mount Pisgah Academy, getting ready to head out here to California for our 18 years of ministry in this conference. We had, well, I don't know what else to call it affectionately except a bomb. Now, I know that's a different connotation today than, you know, when I was around in that age. I almost feel sorry for this current generation. I have to check with my colleagues at the other college churches. Is it true for you, like it is for me, that a lot of the students drive better cars now than we do? Isn't that irritating? something just fundamentally unfair about that. In my generation going through, we all had bombs of a car. You know what I'm talking about? You pull into a gas station and you say, please check the gas, but fill up the oil, fill up the transmission fluid, fill up the brake fluid, and please check the radiator level. In fact, I was using the term roadside bomb years before there was an Iraq war. I'll wait for some of you to catch up with that one. We knew we weren't going to make it across country with that old bomb. So we made arrangements to buy a little Honda just after they moved from the cracker box size, you know, to the just a little bit bigger size. We had our eye on a little blue two-door hatchback Honda. We went down to the dealer, but we were smart. Just before we went down there, we cleaned up the old bomb, got it looking about as good as you can make an old bomb look. Stopped two blocks from the place and you know, filled up the oil and filled up the transmission fluid and checked the radiator and used a little bit of that oil to anoint the car and, you know, had a couple prayers for it. And we drove it in, sat down with the guy, said, we want that blue Honda. He said, okay, here's what it'll cost you. We knew at those days you didn't negotiate on the Honda. That's what you paid. Then he asked the big question, well, do you, you got a trade-in? Yeah, we do. It's a, we have a trade-in. We're anxious to share this with you. He said, really? Well, let me go take a look at it. So we handed him the keys and he went out, and Jan and I had a little prayer service again there, you know. I looked at Jan and I said, you know, if he gives us $400 for this thing, we ought to just jump for joy. You know? Well, he was gone for a few minutes, drove it around, came back in, sat back down at his desk. And you know how they do, they don't say anything for a few minutes, you know. So he was writing on his notes and looking at things, and he leaned back in his chair and kind of stroked his chin a little bit. I think a little bit. I just wish he'd say it, you know. I thought what he was going to say was, we'll only add $250 to the price to take this off your hands. But he said, well, Mr. Thurber, not many people call me Mr. Thurber in those days. Tell you what, I'll give you $500 for your car. I still have little bite marks on the inside of my cheeks right here because I didn't want to smile too big and blow the deal. Because I thought, if this guy has any idea what he's getting, he'll run away from the deal. This was back in the days when I thought you could fool a car dealer. But I've learned since, you can't fool the car dealer. He knows. He knows. He knows. He knows. Our problem is one of memory. We forget things that he remembers. $100 bill. I like the way they pop, don't you? This one hadn't even been folded yet. Nice and crisp. Worth $100 in the United States. Worth in Texas, just like it is in California, $100. At least that's what I thought until I went to buy gas here in California this week. How do you guys do that? Man. It's worth it just to commute to Texas and buy gas and drive back. So maybe $100 isn't worth everywhere the same way. But, you know, $100 is $100. You know what it'll buy you. You give it to the cashier, they're going to give you something for your money. Hand it to them like this. They'll look at it and make sure it's real. But they'll give you what you get. Tell me, I'm going to fold it in half. What's it worth now? Not 50? It's only half itself, right? What's it worth now? Well, it's only a quarter its size. It'll only be worth what? $25 now? Or maybe $12.50? We're down to that? What's it worth? It's still worth $100. Isn't that amazing? You can fold it in all kinds of crazy ways. You know, twist it around like this. What's it worth? $100. What's it worth? I sure hope this is not illegal because I'm on the television here. What's it worth? See, we forget what he always remembers. When the impression goes on this bill, its value is built in. The moment you were created, the impression of the character and person of God went in your soul. Your value was built in at that moment. And it doesn't matter how many times you've been crushed or folded or bent or stomped on. You are still God's child. For not a moment of your life have you ever been left alone. For not a moment of your life have you ever been unloved.
Father, thank you for the fact that when you come into our lives, you make a difference and you change us and make us better people and better parents and teachers and in everything we do. Please continue to fill us as we go through the week. In your name, amen.
You have been listening to the broadcast from the Midland Seventh-day Adventist Church at 2420 East Ashman in Midland, Michigan. If you are in the area, we cordially invite you to visit our church Saturday mornings. If you are a distance away, we encourage you to continue visiting our website and weekly podcast at midlandsda.org.